queen, after she was permitted to leave, after she finally threw the fear up, the only word that popped into her head was hungry. The missionary looked hungry, like if he could, he would devour her. Every day Akuya woke her daughters up while the sun was still sleeping. She wrapped her wrapper, and then walked with her girls out into the dirt roads where Nanasawa, Akos, Mambi, and all of the other women of Ejiso had already begun to assemble. Akuya's voice was the strongest, and so she led them in song. Aradinya me kumdam, obwadinya me kumdam, eneye kokumdam afadye, obwadye niyami kumdam. Susubehun, mejedebehun. Up and down the streets they sang. Akuya's toddler, Amasawa, sang the loudest and most off-key. Her words a slew of gibberish until the song reached her favorite part, at which point she screamed more than sang. Creator God, defeat the troops. Sometimes the women put her in the very front, and her little legs would stomp about valiantly until Akuya picked her up to carry her the rest of the way. After the singing, Akuya went back to wash herself and the children, put white clay on her body as a symbol of her support for the war efforts, eat, then sing again. They cooked for the men in shifts so that there was always something to send away. At night, Akuya would sleep alone, dreaming of the fire still, screaming again now that Asamoah was gone. Akuya and Asamoah had been married for 5 years. He was a tradesman, and he had business in Kumasi. He had seen her one day at the missionary school and had stopped to talk to her. And from then on, he stopped to talk to her every single day. 2 weeks later, he was back to ask if she would marry him and come to live in Ejiso, for he knew she was an orphan, with no other place to live. Akuya found nothing particularly remarkable about Asamoah. He was not handsome, like the man called Kwasi, who came to church every Sunday, standing timidly in the back and pretending not to notice as the mothers threw their daughters at him. Asamoah also seemed to possess little mental intelligence, for his whole life had been about the intelligence of the body, what he could catch or build or lift to take with him to market. She had once seen him sell 2 kente for the price of 1 because he could not count the money correctly. Asamoah was not the best choice, but he was the sure one, and Akuya was happy to accept his proposal. Up until then, she had thought she would have to stay with the missionary forever, playing his strange game of student, teacher, heathen, savior. But with Asamoah, she saw that maybe her life could be something different from what she had always imagined it would be. "I forbid it," the missionary said when she told him. "You can't forbid it," Akuya said. Now that she had a plan, a hope for a way out, she felt emboldened. You are a sinner," the missionary whispered, his head in his hands. "You are a heathen," he said louder now. "You must ask God to forgive your sins." Akuya didn't respond. For nearly 10 years, she had filled the missionary's hunger. Now she wanted to attend to her own. "Ask God to forgive your sins," the missionary yelled, throwing his switch at her. The switch hit Akuya on the left shoulder. She watched it drop to the floor, and then calmly, she walked out. Behind her, she could hear the missionary saying, "He's not a man of God. He's not a man of God." But Akuya cared nothing for God. She was 16. And the fetish priest had died only a year before. She used to go to him whenever she could get away from the missionary. She used to tell him that the more she learned about God from the missionary, the more questions she had. Big questions. Like, if God was so big, so powerful, why did he need the white man to bring him to them? Why could he not tell them himself, make his presence known as he had in the days written about in the book, with bushfires and dead men walking? Why had her mother run to these missionaries, these white people, out of all people? Why did she have no family, no friends? Whenever she asked the missionary these questions, he refused to answer her. The fetish man told her that maybe the Christian God was a question, a great and swirling circle of whys. This answer never satisfied Aquia, and by the time the fetish man died, God no longer satisfied her either. Asamoa was real, tangible. His arms were as thick as yams, and his skin as brown. If God was why, then Asamoa was yes, and yes again. Now that war had come for them, Aquia noticed that Nanasawa was nicer to her than she had ever before been. Word of this man and that man dying came in every day, and they were both holding their breath, certain that it was only a matter of time before the name out of the messenger's mouth was Asamoa. Ejiso was empty. The absence of the men felt like its own presence. Sometimes Aquia would think that not much at all had changed, but then she would see the empty fields, the rotting yams, the wailing women. Aquia's dreams were getting worse, too. In them, the fire woman raged against the loss of her children. Sometimes she spoke to Aquia, calling her, it seemed. She looked familiar, and Aquia wanted to ask her questions. She wanted to know if the fire woman knew the white man who had been burned. If everyone touched by fire was a part of the same world. If she was being called. Instead, she didn't speak. She woke up screaming. In the midst of all this turmoil, Aquia was pregnant. At least 6 months now, she figured by the shape and firm weight of her belly. One day, more than halfway through the war, Aquia was boiling yams to send to the soldiers, and she could not lift her eyes from the fire. "This again?" Nanasawa said. "I thought we had finished with your idleness. Are our people out fighting so that you can stare into the fire and scream at night for your children to hear?" "No, Ma," Aquia said, shaking herself out of her stupor. But the next day, she did it again. And again her mother-in-law scolded her. The same thing happened the day after that, and then the one after that, until Nanasawa decided that Aquia was sick and that she must stay in her hut until the sickness had left her body. Her daughters would stay with Nanasawa until Aquia had fully healed. The first day of her hut exile, Aquia was thankful for the break. She had not had rest since the men left for war, always marching through town singing the war songs, or standing on her feet sweating into a large pot. Her plan was to not sleep until night had fallen, to lie on the side of the hut where Asamoa usually lay, trying to conjure up the smell of him to keep her company until night fell over the hut, casting its awful darkness into the room. But within hours, Aquia was asleep, and the firewoman had reappeared. She was growing, her hair a wild bush of ochre and blue. She was growing bolder, no longer simply burning the things that were around her, but now acknowledging Aquia, seeing her. "Where are your children?" she asked. Akuya was too afraid to answer her. She could feel that her body was in the cut. She could feel that she was dreaming. And yet she could not exert control over that feeling. She could not tell that feeling to grow hands, nudge her body into waking. She could not tell that feeling to throw water on the firewoman, put her out of her dreams. "You must always know where your children are," the firewoman continued, and Akuya shuddered. The next day she tried to leave the hut, but Nana Sewa had the fat man sit at her door. His body, too fat to fight in the war that his peers were in, was just the right size for locking Akuya in. "Please," Akuya shouted, "just let me see my children." But the fat man would not budge. Nana Sewa, standing next to him, shouted back, "You can see them once you are no longer sick." Akuya fought for the rest of the day. She pushed, but the fat man did not move. She screamed, but he did not speak. She banged on the door, but his ears would not hear. Periodically, Akuya could hear Nana Sewa coming to him, bringing him food to eat and water to drink. He said thank you, but nothing else. It was as though he felt like he had found his way to serve. The war had come to Akuya's door. By nightfall, Akuya was afraid to speak. She crouched in the corner of the hut, praying to every god she had ever known, the Christian god whom the missionaries had always described in terms both angry and loving. Inyame, the Akan god, all-knowing and all-seeing. She prayed too to Asaseya and her children, Bia and Tano. She even prayed to Anansi, though he was nothing more than the trickster people put in their stories to amuse themselves. She prayed aloud and feverishly so that she would not sleep, and by the morning she was too weak to fight the fat man, too weak to know if he was even still there. For a week she stayed like this. She had never understood the missionaries when they said they could sometimes spend a whole day in prayer. But now she did. Prayer was not a sacred or holy thing. It was not spoken plainly in Twi or English. It need not be performed on the knees or with folded palms. For Akuya, prayer was a frenzied chant, a language for those desires of the heart that even the mind did not recognize were there. It was the scraping up of the clay floor into her dark palms. It was the crouching in the shadow of the room. It was the one-syllable word that escaped her lips over and over and over again. Fire. 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 The missionary would not let Akuya leave the orphanage to marry Asamoa. Since the day she told him of Asamoa's proposal, he had stopped his lessons, stopped telling her that she was a heathen or asking her to repent her sins, to repeat, "God bless the queen." He only watched her. "You can't keep me here," Akuya said. She was gathering the last of her things out of her quarters. Asamoa would be back before nightfall to get her. Ejiso was waiting. The missionary stood in the doorframe, his switch in his hand. "What? Will you beat me until I stay?" she asked. "You have to kill me to keep me here." "I'll tell you about your mother," the missionary finally said. He dropped the switch to the floor and walked toward Akuya until he was standing so close she could smell the faint stench of fish on his breath. For 10 years, he had come no closer to her than the length of that switch. For 10 years, he had refused to answer her questions about her family. "I'll tell you about your mother. Anything you want to know?" Akuya took a step back from him. and he did the same. He looked down. Your mother, Abina. She wouldn't repent, the missionary said. She came to us pregnant. You, her sin. But still she wouldn't repent. She spit at the British. She was argumentative and angry. I believe she was glad of her sins. I believe she did not regret you or your father, even though he did not care for her as a man should. The missionary was speaking softly, so softly that Akuiya couldn't be certain that she was hearing him at all. After you were born, I took her to the water to be baptized. She didn't want to go, but I forced her. She thrashed as I carried her through the forest, to the river. She thrashed as I lowered her down into the water. She thrashed and thrashed and thrashed, and then she was still. The missionary lifted his head and looked at her finally. I only wanted her to repent. I only wanted her to repent. The missionary started crying. It was not the sight of tears that caught Akuiya's attention so much as the sound. The terrible sound. The heaving sound, like something wrenched from the throat. Where is her body? Akuiya asked. What did you do with her body? The sound stopped. The missionary spoke. I burned it in the forest. I burned it with all of her things. God forgive me. God forgive me. The sound returned. This time shuddering came with it, a shaking so violent that soon the missionary fell down to the ground. Akuiya had to walk over his body to leave. Asamoah returned at the end of the week. Akuiya could hear him with her growing ear, though she could not yet see him. She felt weighted to the ground, her limbs heavy logs on the floor of some dark forest. At the door, Nanasewa was sobbing and screaming. My son, oh, my son! My son, oh, my son! Then Akuiya's growing ear heard a new sound. Loud step, space. Loud step, space.
What is the fat man doing here?
Asamoah asked. His voice was loud enough that Akuiya considered moving. But it was as though she were in the dream space again, unable to make her body do what her mind wanted it to. Nanasewa could not answer her son. So busy was she in her wailing. The fat man moved, his enormous girth a boulder rolling to reveal the door. Asamoah entered the room, but still Akuiya could not get up.
What is the meaning of this?
Asamoah roared, and Nanasewa was shaken from her wailing. She was sick. She was sick, so we... Her voice trailed. Akuiya could hear the sound again. Loud step, space. Loud step, space. Loud step, space. Then Asamoah was standing in front of her, but instead of two legs, she only saw one. He crouched down carefully so that their eyes could better meet, balancing so well that Akuiya wondered how long it had been since he'd last seen the missing leg. He seemed so well acquainted with the space. He noticed her swollen belly and shuddered. He reached out his hand. Akuiya looked at it. She had not slept in a week. Ants had begun to pass over her fingers, and she wanted to shake them off, or give them to Asamoah, lace her small fingers between his large ones. Asamoah stood and turned to his mother. Where are the girls? He asked. And Nanasewa, who had started crying anew, this time at the sight of Akuiya trapped on the ground, ran to fetch them. Amasuwa and Abi came in. To Akuya, they looked unchanged. Both girls still sucked their thumbs, despite the fact that Nana Suwa put hot pepper on the tips of them every morning, noon, and night to warn them away. The girls were developing a taste for heat. They looked from Asamoah to Akuya, holding hands with their grandmother, thumbs in mouths. Then, wordlessly, Abi wrapped her entire little body around her father's leg as though it were a trunk, as though it were the fufu stick she was so fond of holding, stronger than she was, sturdier. The toddler, Amasuwa, moved closer to Akuya, and she could see that she had been crying. A thick line of snot trailed from her nose to lick her upper lip, her mouth gaping wide open. It looked like a slug exiting a cave in order to enter a cavern. She touched her father's knee but kept moving to rest where Akuya was. Then she lay down beside her. Akuya could feel her little heart beating in time with her own broken one. She reached out to touch her daughter, to pull her into her arms. And then she stood and surveyed the room. The war ended in September, and the earth around them began to register the Ashanti loss. Long fissures in the red clay formed about Akuya's compound, so dry was the season. Crops died, and food was limited, for they had given all they had to the men who were fighting. They had given all they had, assured that it would come back to them in the abundance of freedom. Ya Ashantiwa, Ejiso's warrior queen mother, was exiled to the Seychelles, never to be seen again by those who lived in the village. Sometimes Akuya would walk by her palace in her wanderings and wonder, what if? The day she had gotten up from the ground, she had not wanted to speak, nor would she let her children or Asamoah leave her sight. And so the broken family nestled into one another, each hoping the other's presences would fill the wound their personal war had left behind. In the beginning, Asamoah did not want to touch her, and she did not want to be touched. The space where his leg had been taunted her. She could not figure out how to situate her body next to his while they lay in bed at night. In the past, she would curl into him, one of her legs intertwined between his two. But now, she could not get comfortable, and her restlessness fed his restlessness. Akuya no longer slept through the night, but Asamoah hated to see her awake and tortured, and so she pretended to sleep, allowing the waves of her breasts to rise and fall to the current of breaths. Sometimes Asamoah would turn and stare at her. She could feel him considering her while she pretended to sleep, and if she slipped, opened her eyes, or lost her breathing rhythm, his big booming voice would command her to sleep. If she convinced him, she would wait for his real breathing to match her contrived one, and then she would lie there, wishing the firewoman away. If she slept, she would do so only lightly, dipping the ladle of sleep into the shallow pool of dreamland, hoping she would not see the firewoman there before she beckoned herself awake. Then, one day, Asamoah no longer wanted to sleep. He nuzzled Akuya's neck.
"I know you're awake," he said. "I know you do not sleep these days, Akuya."
And still she tried to pretend, ignoring his hot breath against her skin, breathing still and the same.
"Akuya," he said.
He had turned his body so that his mouth now met her ear, and the sound of her name was a strong stick hitting a hollow drum. She did not answer, as he continued to speak her name. The first day she'd left the house after her week of exile. The townspeople had looked away as she passed, embarrassed and ashamed of how they had let Nana Sawa treat her. Her mother-in-law, too, could not see her without bursting into tears, her pleas for forgiveness muffled by the sound. It was only Kofi Poku, the child who had pointed out the white man, the evil one, and so consigned him to burn, who saw the silent Akuya and whispered,
"Crazy woman.
Crazy woman, wife of crippled man." That night, crippled man turned crazy woman onto her back and entered her, forcefully at first, and then more timidly. She opened her eyes to see him working more slowly than he used to, using his arms to push off, push in, his sweat dripping slowly off the bridge of his nose to land on her forehead and trickle down to meet the floor. When he finished, Asamoah turned away from her and wept. Their daughters were asleep across from them, thumbs in mouths. Akuya turned too. Exhausted, she slept. And in the morning, when she realized that she had not dreamed of fire, she felt that she would be all right. And weeks later, when Nana Sawa snatched baby Yao from between Akuya's legs with one hand and sliced the cord with the other, when Akuya heard his loud and mewling cry, she knew that her son would be all right too. Slowly Akuya began to speak more. She slept rarely, but when she did, she would wander. Some days she woke up at the door, other days curled up between her daughters. The sleep time was short, quick, so that as soon as she had moved, she was awake again. She would return to her place beside Asamoah, stare at the straw and mud of the roof above them, until the sun began to peek through the cracks. Rarely, Asamoah would catch her in her night wanderings while he himself was in mid-sleep. He'd reach for his machete, then remember his missing leg, and give up. Defeated, Akuya thought, by his wife and his own misery. Akuya was wary of the villagers, and the only people who brought her any joy were her children. Amasawa was speaking real words now, leaving behind the fast and frantic nonsense speech of her early twos. Now no one questioned Akuya when she wanted to take long walks with her children. They didn't question her when she thought a stick was a snake, or when she left the food in the fire to burn. When they whispered, "Crazy woman," they had to do it behind Nana Sewa's back, because if the woman heard them, she would give them a tongue-lashing that would sting almost as much as the real thing. Akuya would start each walk by asking her daughters where they wanted to go. She would sling baby Yao in a wrapper around her back and wait for the girls to direct her. Often, they would say the same things. They wanted to walk by Ya Asantewa's palace. The palace had been preserved in her honor, and the girls liked to stand outside the gate, singing the post-war songs. Their favorite one was, "Kokohinko, Ya Asantewaye, Obabasio Jina Premwanue, Waye Biejai, Nuabomodin." Sometimes Akuya would sing along softly, rocking Yao back and forth in time with the music as she praised the women who fought before cannons. The girls would need to rest often, and their favorite spot to do it was underneath trees. Akuya would spend long afternoons with them, napping in the small slices of shade provided by impossibly large trees. "I want to be like Ya Asantewa when I am an old lady," Amasawa declared on one such day. The girls had grown too tired to keep walking, and the only tree nearby was the one where the white man had burned. The blackness of the charred bark seemed to crawl up from the roots and toward the lowest branches. Akuya resisted stopping there at first, but the baby's weight made her feel like she was carrying 10 handfuls of yam. Finally she stopped, lying flat on her back, the small mountain of her not-yet-deflated belly hiding her girls from sight as they lay at her feet, Yao at her side. "Will they sing songs about you, my dear?" Akuya asked, and Amasewa burst into giggles. "Yes," she said. "They'll say, 'Look at the old lady, Amasewa. Isn't she strong and pretty too?'" "And what about you, Abi?" Akuya asked, shielding her eyes from the mighty midday sun. "Ya Asantewa was queen mother, daughter of a big man," Abi said. "That is why she gets a song. Amasewa and I are only the daughters of a crazy woman raised by white men." Akuya could not move as readily as she once used to. She didn't know if this was because of the baby that had grown in her stomach, demanding her food and energy, or if it was a result of her week spent in exile on the floor of her hut. She wanted to spring to her feet, to look her daughter in the eye, but all she could manage was a gentle torque of her lower back, first to the left and then to the right, until she had gathered enough force to sit up and see Abi, who was playing with the peeling bark. "Who told you I am crazy?" she asked, and the child, who could not yet tell if she was on the verge of getting in trouble, shrugged. Akuya wanted to be angrier, but she couldn't find the energy anywhere in her body. She needed to sleep, really sleep. 2 days before, she had forgotten the yams she dropped into the oil, forgotten them as her eyes slept. By the time Nana Sewa shook her awake, the yams had burned to black. Her mother-in-law had said nothing. "Everyone says you are crazy," she said. "Sometimes Nana yells at them when they say it, but they still do." Akuya rested her head against a rock and did not speak until she heard the girl's soft and sleepy breaths floating about her like tiny butterflies. That night, Akuya took the children home. Asamoah was eating in the middle of the compound when they walked in.
"How are my girls?"
he asked as his daughters rushed toward him to receive their hugs. Akuya hung back, her eyes following her daughters as they made their way into the hut. It had been a hot day, and Amasewa was already peeling off her wrapper as she ran inside. It waved behind her like a flag.
"And how is my son?"
Asamoah asked Akuya's back, where Yao hung cradled in fabric. Akuya walked toward her husband so that he could touch the baby. "In Yami willing, he is good," she said, and Asamoah grunted his assent.
"Come, get food to eat," he said.
He called for his mother and she appeared within seconds. Her old age had not diminished her swiftness, nor had it diminished her ear's ability to distinguish the needy cry of her oldest son. She came out and nodded at Akuya. She had stopped weeping at the sight of her only days before.
"You must eat so that your milk is rich," she said, dipping her hands into the washing bowl so that she could begin the fufu.
Akuya ate until her stomach grew. It looked like it could be punctured, like sweet milk would flow from her belly button, and that was all that she could picture as she cleaned her hands. Milk flowing below her feet like a river. She thanked Nana Sewa and twisted herself up off the stool that she had been sitting on. She reached out her hands to Asamoah, so that he too could hop up, grabbed the baby, and then went into their hut. The girls were already sleeping. Aquia envied them, the ease with which they entered the dream world. They sucked their thumbs still, unfazed by the pepper their grandmother applied every morning. Beside her, Asamoah rolled once, twice. He too had been sleeping better than he had in the early days of his return. Sometimes he would reach for the ghost of his leg in the middle of the night, and then, finding his hands empty, he would cry softly. Aquia never mentioned this to him when he awoke. Now, flat-backed in their hut, Aquia allowed herself to close her eyes. She imagined that she was lying on the sand of the beaches of Cape Coast. Sleep came for her like waves, first licking her curling toes, her swollen feet, her aching ankles. By the time it hit her mouth, nose, eyes, she was no longer afraid of it. When she entered the dreamland, she was on the same beach. She had been there only once with the missionaries from the school. They had wanted to start a new school in a nearby village but found the townspeople unwelcoming. Aquia had been mesmerized by the color of the water. It was a color she had never had a word for because nothing like it appeared in her world. No tree green, no sky blue, no stone or yam or clay could capture it. In dreamland, Aquia walked to the edge of the rolling ocean. She dipped her toe into water so cool she felt she could taste it, like a breeze hitting the back of the throat. Then the breeze turned hot as the ocean caught fire. The breeze from the back of Aquia's throat began to swirl, round and round, gathering speed, until it could no longer be contained within Aquia's mouth. And so she shot it out, and the spit-out breeze began to move the fiery ocean, dipping down into the depths to collect itself until spiraling wind and fiery ocean became the woman that Aquia now felt she knew so well. This time, the fire woman was not angry. She beckoned Aquia out onto the ocean, and though afraid, Aquia took her first step. Her feet burned. When she lifted one up, she could smell her own flesh wafting from the bottom. Still, she moved, following the firewoman, until she led her to a place that looked like Aquia's own hut. Now in the firewoman's arms were the two fire children that she had held the first time Aquia dreamed of her. They were locked into either arm, head resting on either breast. Their cries were soundless, but Aquia could see the sound floating out of their mouths like puffs of smoke from the fetish man's favored pipe. Aquia had the urge to hold them, and she reached out her hands to them. Her hands caught fire, but she touched them still. Soon she cradled them with her own burning hands, playing with the braided ropes of fire that made up their hair, their cold black lips. She felt calm, happy even, that the firewoman had found her children again at last. And as she held them, the firewoman did not protest. She did not try to snatch them away. Instead, she watched, crying from joy, and her tears were the color of the ocean water in Fantiland, that not green, not blue color that Aquia remembered from her youth. The color began to gather, blue and more blue, green and more green, until the torrent of tears began to put out the fire in Aquia's hands, until the children began to disappear.
Aquia! The crazy woman! Akuya, the crazy woman.
She felt the sound of her name in the growing pit of her stomach, the weight like worry. Her eyes began to open, and she saw Ejiso around her. She was being carried, 10 men at least, lifting her above their heads. She registered all of this before she registered the pain she was in, looked down to see her burned hands and feet. The wailing women were behind the men.
"Evil woman," some of them cried. "Wicked one," said others.
Asamoah was behind the wailing women, hopping with his stick, trying to keep up. Then they were tying her to the burning tree. Akuya found her voice.
"Please, brothers, tell me what is going on."
Antri Eje, an elder, began to bellow.
"She wants to know what is going on," he cried to the men who had gathered.
They wrapped the rope around Akuya's wrists. Her burns screamed, and then she. Antri Eje continued.
"What kind of evil does not know itself?" he asked.
And the crowd stamped its many feet against the hard earth. They slung the rope around Akuya's waist.
"We have known her as the crazy woman, and now she has shown herself to us. Wicked woman. Evil woman. Raised by white men, she can die like one too."
Asamoah pushed his way to the front of the crowd.
"Please," he said.
"You're on her side. The woman who killed your children!"
Antri Eje screamed. His anger was echoed in the yells of the crowd, in the stomping feet and beating hands, the undulating tongues.
Akuya could not think. The woman who killed her children. The woman who killed her children. She was asleep. She must still be asleep.
Asamoah began to weep. He looked Akuya in the eyes, and with her own, she begged him questions.
"Yao is still alive. I grabbed him before he died, but I could only carry one," he said, looking at Akuya still, but speaking to the crowd. "My son will need her. You cannot take her from me."
He looked at Antri Eje, and then to the people of Ejiso. The ones who had been sleeping were now awake, had filtered in to join the others, waiting to see the evil woman burn.
"Have I not lost enough flesh?" Asamoah asked them.
Before long, they cut Akuya down. They left her and Asamoah to get themselves back to the hut. Nanasewa and the doctor were tending to Yawo's wounds. The baby was screaming, the sound seeming to come from somewhere outside of himself. They would not tell her where they had put Abi and Amasewa. They would not say anything at all.
Willie. It was a Saturday, fall. Willie stood in the back of the church holding her songbook open with one hand so that she could clap the beat against her leg with the other. Sister Bertha and Sister Dora were the soprano and alto leads, generous, big-bosomed women who believed the rapture was coming any day now.
"Willie, what you need to do is let yourself sing, girl," Sister Bertha said.
Willie had come in straight from cleaning a house. She'd rushed to remove her apron as she walked in, but though she didn't know it, a smear of chicken grease still lined her forehead. Carson was sitting in the audience. Bored, Willie figured. He kept asking her about school, but she couldn't let him go until baby Josephine got old enough to go. He narrowed his eyes at her when she told him, and sometimes she dreamed about sending him down south to stay with her sister Hazel. Maybe she wouldn't mind a child with that much hate floating around in his eyes. But Willie knew she could never actually do it. In her letters down home, she wrote about how things were going well, how Robert was getting on nicely. Hazel would write back that she would come visit soon, but Willie knew she never would. the South was hers. She wanted no part of the North.
"Yes, what you need to do is let the Lord take that cross you carryin'," Sister Dora said.
Willie smiled. She hummed the alto line.
"You ready to go?"
she asked Carson when she got off stage.
"Been ready," he said.
She and Carson left the church. It was a cold fall day, a crisp wind coming toward them from the river. There were a few cars on the street, and Willie saw a rich, mahogany-colored woman walk by in a raccoon coat that looked soft as a cloud. On Lenox, every other marquee said that Duke Ellington would be playing there Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
"Let's walk a little longer," Willie said.
And Carson shrugged, but he took his hands out of his pockets and his step picked up, so she could see that she had finally said the right thing. They stopped to let some cars pass, and Willie looked up to see six little children looking down at her from an apartment building window. It was a pyramid of children, the oldest, tallest, lining the back row, the youngest in front. Willie reached her hand up and waved, but then a woman snatched them away and closed the curtains. She and Carson crossed the street. It seemed like there were hundreds of people out in Harlem that day. Thousands, even. The sidewalks were sinking with the weight, some literally cracking beneath them. Willie saw a man the color of milky tea singing on the street. Beside him, a tree-bark woman clapped her hands and bounced her head. Harlem felt like a big black band with so many heavy instruments, the city stage was collapsing. They turned south on 7th, past the barbershop that Willie swept from time to time to earn a few cents, past several bars and one ice cream parlor. Willie reached into her purse and felt around until her hand hit metal. She tossed a nickel to Carson, and the boy smiled at her for what seemed like the first time in years. The sweetness of the smile was bitter, too, for it reminded Willie of the days of his endless crying, the days when there was no one in the world except for the two of them, and she was not enough for him. She was barely enough for herself. He raced in to buy a cone, and when he came back out with it, the two of them kept walking. If Willie could have taken 7th Avenue South all the way back down to Pratt City, she probably would have. Carson licked his ice cream cone delicately, sculpting that round shape with his own tongue. He would lick all the way around, and then look at it carefully. Lick again. She couldn't remember the last time she had seen him so happy, and how easy it was to make him that way. All it took was a nickel and a walk. If they walked forever, maybe she would start to get happy too. She might be able to forget how she'd wound up in Harlem, away from Pratt City, away from home. Willie wasn't coal black. She'd seen enough coal in her lifetime to know that for sure. But the day Robert Clifton came with his father to the union meeting to hear Willie sing, all she could think was that he was the whitest black boy she had ever seen. And because she thought that, her own skin had started to look to her more and more like the thing her father brought home from the mines, under his fingernails, and dusting his clothes every single day. Willie had been singing the national anthem at union meetings for the past year and a half. Her father, H., was the union leader, so it hadn't been very hard to convince him to let her sing. The day Robert came in, Willie was in the back room of the church practicing her scales.
"You ready?" her daddy asked.
Before Willie had begged to sing, there was no anthem sung at union meetings. Willie nodded and went out to the sanctuary where all the union members were waiting. She was young, but she already knew that she was the best singer in Pratt City, maybe even in all of Birmingham. Everyone, women and children alike, came to the meetings just to hear that old-world weary voice come out of her 10-year-old body. "Please stand for the anthem," H said to the crowd, and they did. Willie's father teared up the first time she'd sung it. Afterward, Willie could hear a man say,
"Look at old Two Shovel. Getting soft, ain't he?"
Now Willie sang the anthem, and the crowd watched, beaming. She imagined that the sound came from a cave at the very bottom of her gut, that like her father and all the men in front of her, she was a miner reaching deep down inside of her to pull something valuable out. When she finished, everyone in the room stood and clapped and whistled, and that was how she knew she had reached the rock at the bottom of the cave. Afterward, the miners went on with their meeting, and Willie sat in her father's lap, bored, wishing she could sing again.
"Willie, you sang awfully pretty tonight," a man said after the meeting ended.
Willie was standing with her little sister, Hazel, outside of the church, watching the people walk home while H closed up. Willie didn't recognize the man. He was new, an ex-con who'd worked the railroads before coming to work as a free man in the mines.
"I'd like you to meet my son, Robert," the man said. "He's shy, but boy, does he love to hear you sing."
Robert stepped out from behind his father.
"You go on and play for a bit," the man said, pushing Robert forward a little before walking on home.
His father was the color of coffee, but Robert was the color of cream. Willie was used to seeing white and black together in Pratt City, but she'd never seen both things in one family, both in one person.
"You got a nice voice," Robert said. He looked at the ground as he spoke, and kicked up a bit of dust. "I've been coming to hear you sing."
"Thanks," Willie said. Finally, Robert looked at her and smiled, relieved, it seemed, to have spoken. Willie was startled by his eyes.
"Why your eyes look like that?"
Willie asked while Hazel hid behind her leg, eyeing Robert from behind the bend of Willie's knee.
"Like what?"
Robert asked. Willie searched for the word, but realized there wasn't one word to describe it. His eyes looked like a lot of things. Like the clear puddles that stood over the mud that she and Hazel liked to jump in. Or like the shimmering body of a golden ant she had once seen carrying a blade of grass across a hill. His eyes were changing before hers, and she didn't know how to tell him this, so instead, she just shrugged.
"You a white man?" Hazel asked, and Willie pushed her.
"No. Mama say we got a lot of white in our blood, though. Sometimes it take a while to show up."
"That ain't right," Hazel said, shaking her head.
"Your daddy's old as dirt."
"That ain't right neither," Robert said, and before Willie knew what she was doing, she pushed him.
He stumbled, fell down onto his butt, and looked up at Willie with surprise in his brown, green, gold eyes, but she didn't care. Her daddy was one of the best miners Birmingham had ever seen. He was the light of Willie's life, and she was his. He told her all the time how he waited and waited and waited to have her, and when she'd come, he'd been so happy his big, cold heart had melted. Robert stood back up and dusted himself off.
"Ooh," Hazel said, turning toward Willie, never missing an opportunity to shame her. "I'm telling Mama on you."
"No," Robert said. "That's all right." He looked at Willie. "That's all right." The push had broken some kind of barrier between them, and from that day on, Robert and Willie were as close as any two people could be. By the time they hit 16, they were dating, and by 18, they were married, and by 20, they had a child. The people of Pratt City spoke about them in one breath, their names one name, Robert and Willie. The month after Carson was born, Willie's father died, and the month after that, her mother followed.
Miners weren't meant to live long. Willie had friends whose fathers had died when those friends were still swimming in their mothers' bellies, but knowing this didn't lessen the hurt. She was inconsolable those first few days. She didn't want to look at Carson, didn't want to hold him. Robert would take her up in his arms at night, kissing her never-ending tears while the baby slept. "I love you, Willie," he'd whisper, and somehow that love hurt too, made her cry even harder, because she didn't want to believe that anything good could still be in the world when her parents had left it. Willie sang lead in the funeral procession, the weeping and wailing of all the mourners carrying sound down into the very mines themselves. She had never known sadness like that before, nor had she known the fullness of hundreds of people gathering to send her parents off. When she started the song, her voice quivered. It shook something in her. "I shall wear a crown," Willie sang, her voice booming, bouncing from the bottom of the pit and coming back up to meet them all as they walked around the mines. Soon they passed the old potter's field, where hundreds of nameless, faceless men and boys were buried, and Willie was glad that, at least, her father had died free. At least that. "I shall wear a crown," Willie sang again, holding Carson in her arms. His mewling cry was her accompaniment, his heartbeat her metronome. As she sang, she saw the notes float out of her mouth like little butterflies, carrying some of her sadness away, and she knew, finally, that she would survive it. Soon Pratt City started to feel like a speck of dust in Willie's eye. She couldn't be free of it. She could tell that Robert was itching to leave, too. He had always been a little delicate for coal mining. At least that's what the bosses thought every time he got a mind to go ask them for a job, which was about once a year since his 13th birthday. Instead, he worked as a clerk in the Pratt City store. Then, after Carson was born, the store suddenly didn't seem like enough for Robert. He could spend whole weeks complaining about it. "There ain't no honor in it," Robert said to Willie one night. She was seated stomach to stomach with little Carson while he tried to snatch the light that was reflecting off her earrings. "There's honor in mining," Robert said. Willie had always thought that her husband would die in the mines if ever he got a chance to go down. Her father had stopped working in the mines years and years before he died. He was twice the size of Robert, 10 times as strong. Yet still, he almost never stopped coughing, and sometimes when he coughed a string of black mucus would escape his mouth, his face would contort, and his eyes bulge out, so that it looked to Willie as though some invisible man were behind him, hands wrapped around the large trunk of his thick neck, choking him. Though she loved Robert more than she had ever thought it possible to love, when she looked at him, she did not see a man who could handle hands around his neck. She never told him this. Robert began to pace the room. The clock on the wall was 5 minutes behind, and the click of the second hand sounded to Willie like a man clapping off beat at a church revival. Awful, but sure. "We should move. Go north, somewhere I can learn a new trade. Ain't nothing in Pratt City for us now that your folks are gone." "New York," Willie said, just as soon as she had thought it. "Harlem." The word hit her like a memory. Though she had never been there, she could sense its presence in her life. A premonition. A forward memory. "New York, huh?" Robert said with a smile. He took Carson into his arms and the boy cried out, startled, missing the light. "You could find some kind of work?" "I could sing." "You gonna sing, huh?" He dangled his finger in front of Carson's eyes, and they followed him. This way, then that. "What you think about that, Sonny?" "Mama singing." Robert brought the dangling finger down to Carson's soft belly and tickled. The baby screamed with laughter.
"I think he likes that idea, Mama," Robert said, laughing too.